epic. The Ulk Bog stretched out beside her, wormed forward just far enough that he could see something that was still hidden from her. "Watch," he whispered over his shoulder. She did so, peering into the valley, waiting. The minutes passed and nothing happened. Then an ogre of monstrous size lumbered into view, hunched over and shouldering a massive club. It was young, Grian guessed, coarse hair black along its spine and across its shoulders, and its thick skin leathery and smooth. It was shaking its head from side to side and brushing at the air as if to ward off gnats or flies. But she saw neither. "What is it doing?" she whispered. Wekedart's eyes were bright. "Listen." She did, and then she heard it too, a high-pitched, keening sound that seemed to come from everywhere at once. It was clearly bothering the ogre, who was grunting with annoyance, lifting its head every so often in a futile effort to search out the source. The sound intensified steadily, turning to a wail that cut right to the bone, raw and harsh and filled with pain. Finally, the ogre stopped walking altogether, turning this way and that, blunt features twisted into an ugly knot. Grianne flattened herself further. The ogre was looking for something on which to vent its irritation, and she had no desire to provide it with a target. Wekedart lay motionless as well, but she saw the knowing smile at the corners of his mouth. There was anticipation in that smile, and she did not care for the look of it. Suddenly, small, four-legged creatures began to appear, coming out of the grasses and from behind the rocks, a handful at first, and then dozens. Their sharp-featured cat faces and sleek, sinuous shapes were unmistakable. She recognized them at once, even though she had never seen one before. Furies. She had read about them in the druid histories. Only once since their imprisonment had they broken through the forbidding, doing battle with Alanon and nearly killing him. They were creatures of madness and mindless destruction, the worst of the many bad things imprisoned in this world. They attacked in swarms and were drawn to their victims by a hunger for blood. In the world of the Jarkarus, everything avoided them. They closed now on the ogre, coming at it from all directions, so many that she could no longer count them. The ogre waited on them, its small, piggish eyes already anticipating the damage it would inflict on the creatures. Perhaps because it was young, it did not realize the danger it was in. When they attacked, leaping blindly at the ogre, it smashed them like flies, wielding club and fists with equal effect. The furies were smaller and their bodies unprotected, and those it found could not save themselves. But there were too many for the ogre to stop, and soon they had broken through its defenses, biting and tearing at its massive body with teeth and claws. Bits of flesh and patches of hair came away, and in moments the ogre was slashed and bleeding from head to foot. It fought on, killing furies as long as it could, struggling to stay upright. But in the end they pulled it down, severing ligaments and tendons, shredding muscle and flesh, draining its blood and its strength until it was helpless. Bellowing in rage and despair, it disappeared beneath their relentless onslaught, blanketed in a squirming, heaving mass of furry bodies, borne to the earth until its life was gone. Grianne, who had witnessed many terrible and violent deaths in her own world, nevertheless cringed at this one. The ogre meant nothing to her, and yet she was horrified by what had happened to it. She wanted to look away when the ogre was reduced to its final shudders and gasps, but she could not. It took a tap on her arm from Wekedart to recall her to her senses. "This way," the Ulk Bog whispered, "while they are busy." They crawled through the grasses along the top of the rise and then down the reverse slope until they were out of sight. Once concealed from view, they stood and began walking, neither speaking, concentrating on the sounds that came from the other side of the hill. When they were far enough away that they could no longer be heard, even by cat ears, Wekedart turned to her. "Better they find it than us," he said with a wicked smile. She nodded in agreement, but she did not feel good about it. They slept that night in the trees again, and Grianne did not offer any objections. She understood how vulnerable they were to the creatures that roamed the Passionon under cover of darkness. Many she had not even seen, but a single viewing of the Furies was enough to persuade her. The trees offered little enough protection, she guessed, but she would take what she could find. In her dreams that night, she saw the ogre die again, the scene replaying itself in various forms. Sometimes she was simply a spectator, a passive viewer to the death scene. At other times, she was the victim, feeling the teeth and claws of the cat things tear into her, flailing and helpless beneath their attack, thrashing awake in a cold sweat. At other times still, she was a participant, one of the Furies, assisting in the destruction of another hapless creature, driven by bloodlust and hatred, by feelings she thought she had left behind when she had ceased to be the Ill's Witch. She woke tired and out of sorts, but she kept it to herself as they continued their travels east, walking the grasslands through another dismal and oppressive day. They followed the banks of what would have been the Myrmidon in her world. She didn't bother to ask Weka Dart for its name, content to be left alone while he sidled back and forth about her at his own pace. It rained on that day, and even with the great cloak to protect her, she was soon drenched. They saw little of the land's denizens and no sign of the Furies, and for that she was grateful. On the afternoon of the third day, they reached a break in the dragon line that she recognized as the mouth of the pass leading to the Hadeshorn and the Valley of Shale. A twisting, dark defile, it wound upward into the cliffs and disappeared into the mists. "Do you know this place?" she asked Weka Dart. Rain dripped off her hood and into her face, and she brushed it out of her eyes. "Have you been here before?" He shook his head. "Never." He glanced up into the dark mass of rocks. "It doesn't look like a place anyone would want to go."
"It is where I am going," she said. "You needn't. Do you want to wait for me here?"
He shook his head quickly. "I'd better stay with you, in case you need me." They began to climb, working their way through the rubble-strewn foothills until they had reached the base of the mountains. There the terrain turned steeper and more treacherous. There were no signs of passage, no marks on the rocks or wearing down of the earth. The pathway she knew to be there in her own world was not there in the Forbidding, and she was forced to blaze it on her own. Perhaps no one had ever come that way before. Weka Dart trailed her with less enthusiasm than he had displayed on the flats, grumbling and muttering the entire way. She ignored him. It had been his choice to come. She was no happier than he was to have to break the trail. It was not long before they heard the wailing. The sound was unmistakable, a low moaning that might have been just the wind or something alive and in pain. It rose and fell in steady cadence, trailing off entirely at times, only to return seconds later. She tried to ignore it, but found it impossible to do so. Changes in pitch and tone set her teeth on edge. The sound raked the rocks of the pass, tunneled deep into its crevices, and slithered down its gaps. Weka Dart hissed in dismay and frustration and covered his ears with his hands. When she looked back at him, his teeth were bared. The shadows appeared soon after that, sliding out of splits in the walls and from behind rocks. They were not cast as shadows should be, but moved independently of the light, separating themselves from solid objects in ways that should not have been possible. They flowed across the pass, crooked black stains that tracked her progress like predators. When they touched her, their blackness trailed across her skin with icy fingers. She knew instinctively what was happening. She was being told to turn back. She could feel the warning in the touch of the shadows and hear it in the sound of the wailing. But she ignored it, as she knew she must, and continued on. By nightfall, they reached a break in the rocks that opened through a thick curtain of gloom and mist to a hole in the sky. Grianne Ohmsford stared in surprise, then realized that the sky was ink black and empty of stars or moon. There was simply nothing there. She walked forward, unable to believe she was seeing correctly. Beyond the break in the rocks, where the mist and gloom fell away, she found herself standing on a rise that looked out over the Valley of Shale. It was as she remembered it, and yet not. The sharp-edged ebony stones were the same, strewn across the empty slopes like shards of polished glass. But a wall of mist enclosed the valley, a wall so deep and so high that she could see nothing save the black hole of the sky above. The mountains had vanished. The world had disappeared. All that remained was the Hadeshorn, pooled at the bottom of the valley, its still waters shimmering dully in the deep gloom. Its flat, mirrored surface gave off a faintly greenish light that reflected from the pieces of stone. Mist rose off its surface like steam, but no warmth was to be found in those waters. Even from where she stood, Grianne could feel that the lake was as cold as winter and as lethal as death. Nothing lived there that hadn't crossed over into the netherworld long ago. Weka Dart scuttled up behind her and peered about.
This place is evil.
Why are we here?
Because answers to my questions are to be found in the waters of that lake, she replied.
Well, ask your questions quickly, then, and let's be gone.
The wailing began anew, low and insistent, seeping from the stones and filtering through the air. The shadows reappeared, taking form this time, some familiar, some not, swirling about them like phantoms come to haunt. There were no voices, no faces, no human presence, and yet it seemed as if life might be embodied in the shadows and in the wailing, bereft of substance and soul, trapped in the ether. The sounds and the shadows responded to each other, speeding and slowing, rising and falling, a symbiosis that reflected a terrible dependence.
Strachan, do what you must, but do it quickly, Weka Dart urged, and there was fear in his voice.
She nodded without looking at him. There was no reason to wait, nothing to be gained by deliberation. She could not know what waited for her when she summoned the spirits of the dead. It might be different here than in the four lands. It might be lethal. It might be her only hope. Resolved, she started down.
Chapter 21.
She felt the presence of the dead almost immediately. They had assumed the forms of the shadows that flitted about her and taken on the voices that wailed from the rocks. They were a part of the air she breathed. As she descended the slopes, she found them all about her, pressing close, trying to recapture something of the corporeal existence they had left behind in crossing over into the netherworld. Shades felt that absence, she knew. Even dead, they remembered the substance of life. This phenomenon would not have happened in her own world, where shades were confined to the depths of the Hadeshorn, and no trespass into the world of the living was allowed. But in the forbidding, more latitude seemed to be given to the dead, and though not yet summoned from the afterlife, they were already loose in the valley. She sensed another aberration as well. The shades that visited her were not friendly. At best, they were hostile toward all living things, but she sensed a specific antipathy toward herself. She could not determine the reason for that right away. They did not know her personally or possess a specific grudge that would explain their attitude, and yet there was no mistaking it. She felt it prodding at her, small barbs that did not sting so much as scratch. There was disdain and frustration in those scratches. There was outright dislike. Something about her was angering these shades, and although she sought to discover a reason for it, she could not. Shades were difficult to read, their emotions not connected to the physical, and therefore not easily understood. She considered using her magic to push them away, to give herself space in which to breathe. But within the forbidding, her magic could have unforeseen consequences, and she did not want to risk losing a chance to speak with the shades of the druids. Her purpose in coming there was to summon them, and she could not afford to be distracted from that effort. The lesser shades were annoying, but manageable. Even so, her journey to the floor of the valley seemed endless. The shades rubbed on her nerves like sandpaper. Their whispers and icy touches left her unsettled and anxious. She felt something of her old self rise in response, an urge to crush them like dried leaves, a desire to scatter them beneath her boot heels. It was what she would have done once upon a time and not given it a second thought. But she was no longer the ill's witch, and nothing would ever make her be so again. She glanced back at Weka Dart. He sat cross-legged on the rise, hands over his ears, face knotted in determination. He was hanging on, but it was taking everything he had to do so. By the time she reached the edge of the lake, the shadows were draped all about her, frozen scraps of silk burning with death's chill. The wailing was so pervasive that she could hear nothing else, not even the crunching of her boots on the loose stone. The shades had crowded in from every side, gathering strength in numbers until they had enveloped her. She was being suffocated, punished for ignoring their warning. If she failed to rid herself of them quickly, she would be overwhelmed. She stared momentarily at the calm waters of the lake, at its columns of steam, fingers of mist risen straight from the netherworld. She knew better than to touch those waters. In her own world, they were deadly to living things, although druids could survive them. Here, even druids might be at risk. Gathering her wits and focusing her determination, she raised her arms and began the weaving motion that would call forth the druid dead. When the waters of the lake began to stir in response, she added the words that were needed. Slowly the waters began to churn, the steam columns to geyser, and the lake itself to groan like a sleeping giant come awake. The shades already present fell away, taking with them their wailing and their icy touches, leaving dead space and silence in their wake. Once rid of her most bothersome distraction, Grianne brought the full force of her power to bear. Using her skills and her experience, she bore down on this other world's Hadeshorn, manipulating it as she would its twin in the Four Lands, summoning the shades that would serve her cause, beckoning them from the depths to the surface, drawing them with her call. The lake surged and heaved with sudden convulsions, and its greenish waters turned dark and menacing. Waterspouts erupted with booming coughs, angry and violent. The lake hissed and spit like a venomous snake. Her throat tightened and her mouth went dry. Something was wrong. There was resentment in the lake's response. There was resistance. That was not the way it was supposed to be. When the gateway to the netherworld was opened properly, there should be a lowering of barriers that invited adjoining. The shades sought for it. It was their one chance to touch, even briefly, on what they had lost. The lake that gave them that chance had no reason to complain. But it was doing so here. It was more than disgruntled. It was enraged. Had it been so long since a summoning had occurred in that world that the lake failed to recognize it for what it was? Was it possible there had never been a summoning before? She gave herself only a moment to consider all that before refocusing on the task at hand. She had come too far to turn back and would not have done so if she could have. She had made her decision and she would be the equal of whatever happened. It was not bravado or foolhardiness that drove her. It was the certainty that it was her one and only chance to find a way out of this prison. It took everything she had to maintain her concentration. Her instincts were screaming at her to back away, to cease her efforts. The air was filled with sounds and sensations that grated on her resolve and wore at her courage. The Hadeshorn was roiling by then, a volcanic pit threatening to explode with every new gesture she made, with every new word she spoke. Her magic, she saw, was anathema here, stirring the currents that led to the netherworld in the manner of fire on parchment, incendiary and destructive. Still she continued, implacable and unyielding, as hard as the stone upon which she stood. Then the shades began to rise in looping spirals, their transparent forms linked by the trailing iridescence that poured out of their trapped souls. Like shooting stars, they soared from the waters and lifted into the air, bright flashes against the night's firmament. They writhed and wailed piteously, giving vent to the travesty of their imprisonment, their outrage a mirror of her own. They spun like sparks, showered from a fire grown too hot, released in an explosion of heat. But from where she stood on the shore, she felt only a deep, abiding cold that permeated the air and left her exposed skin freezing. Where was Walker? Where was Al-Anon? Where was the help she so badly needed? She bore down, ignoring the cold air and damp spray, the terrible wailing and the debilitating infusion of fear and doubt. She hardened herself as she had been taught to do in darker times, cloaking herself in her magic and her determination, fighting to keep her hold over the lake and its inhabitants. She had opened the door to the world of the dead to seek answers to her questions, and she would not close it again until she found what she had come for. Her search ended when her strength was almost gone. A druid shade surged out of the roiling waters like a leviathan, huge and threatening, scattering lesser shades as if they were krill on which it might feed. Dark robes billowed out, the edges frayed and torn, the opening of its hood a black hole that had no bottom. The lake's greenish light filtered through rents in its empty form, carving intricate patterns that threw strange shadows everywhere. Grianne Ohmsford stepped backwards in shock. It's too big, too massive.
The shade wheeled toward her soundlessly, drawing all the light into itself, extinguishing the smaller shades around it. Within the hood, red eyes flared to life and burned with unmistakable rage. She felt it watching her, measuring her. It advanced as it did so, coming on like a juggernaut that meant to crush her. As powerful as she was, as skilled at magic's uses, she was dwarfed by this presence. She could not decide who it was. Not Walker, she knew. She had spoken with his shade enough times to know how it felt when he appeared. Al-Anon, perhaps? Yes, Al-Anon, darkest of them all. But this dark? She waited as the shade skimmed across the lake's boiling surface to reach her, growing steadily in size. It gave her no hint of whom it was, nor spoke even a single word. It simply advanced, enigmatic and intimidating, testing her resolve to stand fast. She could not look away from it. She was transfixed. When it was close enough that it had blotted out the entirety of the sky behind it, it stopped, hovering above the Hades Horn, its dark form riddled and tattered. Grianne brought her arms down now, lowering them slowly, carefully, keeping her eyes fixed on the crimson orbs that burned out of the impenetrable gap in the shade's hood. "Do you know me, Strachan?" Its voice was as empty and cold as the death that had stolen away its life. Her stomach lurched in sudden recognition. Sweat beaded her forehead, though the rest of her was as cold as that voice. She knew who it was. She knew it instinctively. It wasn't Al-Anon, or Bremen, or even Gallifile. Not here, inside the Forbidding. She had forgotten the importance of where she was. She was in a place where only creatures exiled from the world of faerie belonged. She was in a place where only those who felt at home with such creatures would come, even from the world of the dead. What sort of shade would such creatures draw? Only one, she realized belatedly. The shade of the rebel druid Brona. It was the warlock lord. After Grianne Ohmsford had been stolen away as a child and begun her training as the Ill's Witch, fear was the first emotion she had learned to control. It wasn't easy at first. Her family had been killed and she was hunted still. She had no friends save her rescuer, the Morgar, and he was as dark as anything she had ever imagined. He was impatient and demanding as well, and when she did not perform as he required, he made certain she realized the consequences of failure. It took her years to get past her fears, to harden herself sufficiently that in the end she was afraid of nothing, not even him. But she was afraid now. The fear returned in paralyzing waves that stole away her strength and rooted her in place. It was the warlock lord she had summoned, the most powerful and dangerous creature that had ever lived. What could she hope to do with him? The huge apparition rolled toward her once more, easing across the turgid waters. "Speak my name." She could not. She could do nothing but stare. She had summoned the druid's worst enemy, their most implacable foe, to ask for help that she couldn't possibly hope to receive. It was the worst mistake she had ever made, and she had made many. She had not imagined that anyone but Walker would appear, just as he always did when she came to the Hades Horn. But it was not the Hades Horn of her world, but of the Forbidding, and it made perfect sense that in the world of the Jarkarus, of the banished people, of the despised and the hated, Brona's would be the shade that would respond to any summons. She sensed his impatience. He would not wait much longer for her response. If she failed to give it, he would depart, returning to the netherworld and stealing away her last hope. Refusing to speak with him was pointless. He would already know who she was and what she was doing there. He would know what she was seeking. "No one speaks your name," she said. "You will. You will dare anything, Ill's Witch. Haven't you always?" She cringed inwardly but kept her face expressionless. "You are Brona," she said.
You are the warlock lord.
I am as you name me, Strachan. The name causes you to be afraid. It causes you to question what you have done, as it should. Tell me, why do you summon me?
She mustered her courage, telling herself that he was dead, only a shade, and incapable of harming her physically. Alive, he would have been a very real threat. Dead, he was a threat only if she allowed him to be. If she kept him at bay and controlled her emotions, she was safe enough. She told herself that, but she was not entirely sure. It was not the Four Lands, after all. She was in another world, and the rules might be different.
I am lost, and I want to go home again.
You carry your home inside you, dark and tattered as the robes I wear. You bear it in your heart, a sorry, empty vessel. Ask me something better.
Behind him, the lake rumbled in discontent, and a scattering of lesser shades reappeared at the edges of the warlock lord's dark form, hovering cautiously.
Who sent me here? She asked him.
He made a sound that could have been laughter or something more terrible. Beneath his ragged form, the waters hissed and steamed.
Not those you suspect, foolish girl.
Not other druids? They didn't send me.
They are pawns. Pawns? It made her pause.
Who then?
The dark form shifted anew, blowing spray and cold into her face, sending shivers down her spine.
Ask me something more interesting.
Frustrated, she took a moment to think. Shades were notorious for giving vague or incomplete answers to the living. The trick was in determining from those answers what was real and what was false. It would be doubly hard here.
Why are you even speaking with me? She asked impulsively.
I am Ard Rhys of the Druids, your enemies in life.
You are not what you see yourself to be. You are a changeling who dissembles and pretends. You hide whom you really are inside. Others fail to see it, but I know the truth. I speak to you because you are not like them. You are like me.
Although it made her cold inside, she dismissed the comparison out of hand. She understood well enough its source. He was not the first to see her that way, nor would he be the last. How do I get home again? How do I find my way back?
You cannot. Someone must find you.
Her heart sank, but she forged ahead anyway. No one will ever find me here. No one can even get to me.
You are already found. Someone already comes.
Here? For me? She felt her heart jump. Who does this?
A boy. That stopped her in her tracks.
What boy?
He is your way back. When he comes for you, you must be ready to go with him.
A boy?
She took a deep breath, her throat tightening with the effort.
A boy.
There was more to this, there had to be, but she knew he wouldn't tell her what it was. He would make her wait, because that was the nature of the game he played. Besides, the future was uncertain, even for a shade. He could not tell her if the boy would succeed or fail. He could tell her only that the boy was coming. He would let her imagine the rest. She must go another way. She pulled her cloak closer about her, aware suddenly of how cold she was. It was his presence, the nearness of his evil. Even in death, it was there, in the spray off the lake, in the currents of the air, in the darkness pressing down on her. Death, come alive in the form of this shade, gave power to what he was.
Ask me something more.
His relentlessness had returned, and she was in danger of losing him, but she didn't know where to go next.
Where will I find this boy?
At the doorway through which you entered.
You waste my time. Ask me something that matters.
Is it possible that you are as stupid as you are pathetic?
She stiffened. He was taunting her, and it was working. Tell me why I am still alive. What reason was there for imprisoning rather than killing me? She was certain that he laughed, the sound so raw it made her cringe with embarrassment and rage. The lake's waters spit in response to the sound, and the greenish light that radiated from beneath pulsed with energy.
To serve the needs of the one who brought you here.
What needs are those?
You ask the wrong question. Ask the right one.
Her mind worked furiously, thinking it through. Why am I inside the forbidding? She asked finally. Again the laughter, but cool and soft this time, barely a whisper on the wind.
That is better, little Strachan. You are inside the forbidding so that the one who brought you here could get out.
She caught her breath. Get out? Someone had gotten out. An exchange, she thought. Of course. The power that had imprisoned her belonged to the thing that sought to escape, not to someone from her own world. Something powerful had wanted out, something clever enough to manipulate those it needed in the four lands, and it had found a way through her. The Shade's voice cut through her thoughts, commanding her attention.
Heed me. You understand some, but not all. Here is the truth you must embrace if you are to survive long enough to learn the rest. You cannot cast off your true self. You gain power through acceptance of your destiny. Bury your emotions with your foolish ambitions for the Druid Council. Become who you were meant to be, Ill's Witch. Your magic can make you powerful, even here. Your skills can give you domination. Use both. Wield them as weapons and destroy any that challenge you. If not, you will be destroyed in turn.
I am not the Ill's Witch, she replied.
Nor am I then the Warlock Lord. I have watched you grow. You were powerful once. You disdained that power for foolish reasons. Had you stayed strong, you would not have been sent here like this. But you have grown weak. Death's cold hand is on you. Your time grows short.
The Shade threw out one hand and a wind howled across the lake, whipping at its robes and sending Grianne to her knees. The lesser shades scattered once more, disappearing into the darkness, lost.
The lake boiled anew, spitting and rumbling, a cauldron of discontent, and the Warlock Lord began to retreat back toward its center, burning eyes still fixed on her.
She tried to stand again, but the wind beat her down, and it was all she could do to meet that terrible gaze from her kneeling position.
So much hatred in those featureless orbs, not for her alone, but for everything that lived. Even in death and from the netherworld it sought release.
I am Ard Rhys, she screamed at it in frustration. The Shade did not respond. It reached the center of the lake and sank from sight, its black form vanishing with the quickness of a shadow exposed to light, gone in an instant, leaving only the lake and the sound of the wailing. Waterspouts exploded into the night, and Grianne backed away on her knees, buffeted by the relentless force of the wind. As she backed away, she fell, tearing her clothing and scraping her knees on the rocks. Shadows fell across her, cast by things she couldn't see. She lowered her head, closed her eyes, and pulled her hood tight against her ears.
I am Ard Rhys.
Then abruptly, everything went still. The wind died, the wailing faded, and the lake quieted once more. She kept her head lowered a moment, then lifted it cautiously. The valley was empty of movement and sound, of anything but a flicker of greenish light that emanated from the depths of the lake and reflected off the crushed stone. Overhead, the sky was still black and empty of stars. All about the valley's rim, the wall of mist pressed close. She rose, battered of body and emotions, drained of strength and spirit, and walked away.
Chapter 22. Pendaren Ohmsvert had thought he would sneak off to see Cinnaminson again the following night, and perhaps the night after that as well, if the Skatelow was still in port. His initial assignation had infused him with such joy and excitement that he could hardly wait for the next one to take place. He knew it was wrong to give so much attention to Cinnaminson when he should be thinking about finding his missing aunt. But the latter was far away, the former all too close. He couldn't seem to help himself. In a struggle of emotions, his sense of responsibility finished a distant second to his passion. All that mattered was that he be with Cinnaminson. Having thought of little else all that day, he managed to slip away again the next night, only to find that her father and the other two rovers were still aboard. He stood dockside in the shadows, watching them smoke on deck and listening to their voices. He waited a long time for them to leave, but when it became clear they had no intention of doing so, he gave up and returned to the inn. The second night was even more frustrating. A new storm moved in, more ferocious than the one they had encountered several days earlier, drenching an atchery and halting all traffic for the next 24 hours. The rain was so bad that even on the ground visibility was reduced to almost nothing. Penn knew no one would be venturing out in weather like this, including the rovers aboard the Skatelow. There was no point in even thinking about meeting with Cinnaminson. So he was forced to make do with daydreams, which could not replace the real thing, but which at least gave him an outlet for his frustrations. Sitting around at the Fisherman's Lie for hours at a time, sometimes with Kyber, sometimes with Arren and Tagwin, but mostly alone, he passed the time thinking of ways he could separate her from her father, bring her with him when he returned home, and build a life for the two of them. It was such fantasy that even he knew it didn't bear looking at too closely. He was just a boy and she only a girl, and neither of them had any experience at falling in love. But Penn didn't care. He knew how he felt, and that was enough. Kyber kept him company much of the time, but she spent hours alone in her room working on her druid disciplines and exercises, practicing movements and words and tending to her studies. Arren worked with her each day, but he was gone much of the time, scouting for news of their pursuers and checking on Gar Hatch's progress with the Skatelow. Tagwin surfaced now and again, but mostly he kept to his room. He was less sociable than he had been when it had been just the two of them, and Penn thought it was due in part to his discomfort with life outside of Paranor. Tagwin was used to carrying out his duties for the Ard Ris in the claustrophobic company of the druids, and his time at the inn was too unstructured. What he did when he was alone was a mystery, although Penn caught him writing in a notebook on two occasions, and the dwarf confessed to keeping a diary of their progress to help pass the time. That made as much sense to Penn as what he was doing, moping around about Cinnaminson, so he left the dwarf alone. Kyber, on the other hand, chided both of them mercilessly. More driven and disciplined than either, she found their lack of purpose irritating and took every opportunity to suggest that they ought to do better with their time. Tagwin was incensed, but Penn just ignored her. He was beginning to see her as the big sister he didn't have but had often imagined. She was pushy and insistent, and she thought everyone should see things the way she did. Having talked with her about her life, Penn understood her motivation. She had been forced to fight for everything she had, a young elven princess whose life had been charted out for her by her family without any consideration at all for what she wanted. It had only become worse for her after her father's death and her brother's ascension to the throne. Just to come visit with Arren had required a great deal of fortitude and determination. He could not imagine what would happen to her when her brother found out she was with them. In any case, by the third day, everyone was growing impatient. Penn and his companions were still stuck inside at the inn, and Gar Hatch had given Arren no indication as to when they were going to set sail again. The rains had subsided, but a rise in the temperature had caused a deep fog bank to settle over the Lazarene and the surrounding lakeshore, the port of Anachre included. Visibility continued to hamper travel, and the dockside was quiet.
By mid-afternoon, with their lunch finished and the prospect of another day in port looming ever closer, Aaron announced that he was going down to the waterfront to tell Hatch that whether he liked it or not, they would set sail at dawn. The rover's reputation was that he could sail in any weather and under any conditions. It was time to prove it. The druid was clearly displeased, his patience with Gar Hatch exhausted. Penn exchanged a knowing look with Kyber when Aaron told them to pack and be ready to leave when he returned. The boy did not think that Hatch would be given a chance to offer any more excuses. He wished, however, that he had been able to tell Aaron Elicidal what Cinnaminson had told him, that her father knew who they were, knew of their purpose, and might be making plans of his own. He could not say anything, however, without giving away the fact that he had disobeyed the druid. He rationalized his decision to keep quiet by telling himself that Aaron already suspected Hatch of knowing the truth, which was almost the same as knowing it for a fact, so that the druid was prepared for it anyway. Still, it unsettled him to be keeping secrets from his friends. It wasn't that he didn't trust the druid and his niece and the dwarf. He did. It was just that once he didn't tell them, later, he didn't know how, and it became easier not to do so at all. It wasn't as if he couldn't tell them when it became necessary. If it ever did, maybe it never would. So he kept what he knew about Gar Hatch to himself as Aaron Elicidal went out the door. He plopped down in a wooden chair by the window, alone for the moment, and stared out into the mist. He allowed himself to think briefly of Cinnaminson, then turned his attention for the first time in several days to the more important matter of reaching the Tanaquil. He was beginning to wonder not so much if he could do so, which he firmly believed he could, but if he could do so in time. His aunt was trapped inside the Forbidding, and he knew enough about what was locked away there to realize that even an Ard Ris might have trouble staying alive. He knew she was powerful, that her magic had made her one of the most feared humans in the Four Lands. He knew as well that she was a survivor, that her entire life had been spent finding ways to stay alive when others either wished her dead or were actively looking for ways to make it happen. She would not be killed easily, even by the monsters that dwelled within the Forbidding. But she was alone and friendless there, and that would put her at a decided disadvantage. Sooner or later, that disadvantage would begin to tell. How many days had she been trapped in there already? At least 2 weeks, and that was just the beginning of the time that it would take for him to reach her. Under the best of conditions, he thought, he would need another week or two to find the Tanaquil. Then he had to persuade it to fashion the Dark Wand. Then he had to return to Paranor, get inside the keep, and use the wand to cross over into the Forbidding. How much time would all that require? 2 months? More? Just listing the steps necessary for the rescue demonstrated how impossible the task was. She would be dead before he could reach her. Perhaps she was already dead. He stopped himself angrily. What was he thinking? The King of the Silver River would not bother sending him if he had no chance of success. There would be no point in making the journey. No, his aunt was alive, and she would stay alive until he reached her. She would die only if he talked himself out of going on. If he persuaded himself, he should quit, as he was trying to do now. He took a deep breath and leaned back in his chair. He would not think like that again, he promised himself. He would do what he knew he should and continue on right up until the moment that it became impossible for him to do so. That was what was expected of him. It was what he expected of himself. Then Kyber appeared, sat down without a word, pulled out her folding game board, and cocked an inquisitive eyebrow at him. He smiled, in spite of himself. "I'll give it a try," he said. Several hours passed, and Aaron Elicidal did not return. As dusk approached and the shadows lengthened, rain began to fall once more, a steady, obstinate drizzle that dampened the mist but did nothing to dispel it. Penn went into the common room with Kyber and Tagwin to eat. Mindful of the need to stay anonymous, they took a table in a back corner, well away from the door in the stream of traffic entering and leaving. The druids were still hunting them, the word still abroad that money would be paid for anyone who brought Penn to their attention. Perhaps they should have worried more about Gar Hatch's mercenary tendencies, since rovers were always on the lookout for an easy opportunity to increase their fortunes.
But Aran had not seemed concerned, and Kyber had insisted that because the druid was paying Hatch a great deal more than the rover could get by turning them in, it made better sense for Hatch to stay loyal to them.
"I don't like it that he's been gone so long," Tagwin growled softly, giving Kyber a hard look. "You don't think something might have happened to him, do you?"
She shook her head.
"I think if it had, we would have heard. Word would have spread by now."
"Then where is he?" Penn took a long pull on his mug of ale.
"He might have decided we'd get out of here quicker if he stayed around to supervise Hatch in making the necessary preparations. I don't think he believes the captain has done all that well on his own."
Tagwin grunted, took a piece of bread from his plate and shoved it into his mouth in one monstrous bite. The boy cocked his head.
"I didn't quite catch that."
Kyber was shaking her head in disgust.
The dwarf swallowed. "I said maybe one of us should go and see."
"That would be you," Kyber snapped irritably, "since Penn and I are forbidden to go outside the walls of this grim little lie-down. Do you want to leave now?"
They went back to eating in silence, turning their attention to steaming plates of fresh fish that the server had brought over from the kitchen. Tagwin rubbed his hands together enthusiastically, any plans for going down to the waterfront put aside for the moment. While eating, they finished off the ale pitcher, and an impatient Kyber rose and walked to the serving bar to get another. She was waiting for a refill when the doors to the inn banged open and Taric Molt walked into the room, trailed by half a dozen of his gnome hunters. Heads turned to watch them enter, and conversations died. Penn put down his fork and knife and glanced quickly at Tagwin. The dwarf hadn't seen their enemy yet, but now he caught the look on the boy's face and turned.
"Oh no," he whispered.
They were trapped. The gnome hunters were already spreading out, moving through the crowded room like wraiths. Two remained stationed at the only door leading to the street. Penn thought of fleeing through the kitchen, but he didn't know if it led outside or not. His mind raced, seeking a way of escape. Maybe Molt didn't know they were there. He didn't seem to. He was standing in the middle of the room, black cloak shedding water on the wooden floor, hard eyes scanning the room. It was dark back here. He might not see them. Cows might fly, too. When the druid's gaze finally settled on him, Penn went cold all the way down to his feet. There was no mistaking what he saw in that gaze. He wondered how the druid had found them, how he had come to Anachere when they had been so careful to leave no trail. He glanced quickly at the serving bar and saw Kyber preparing to return to the table. She didn't know who Molt was, having never seen him. She didn't realize the danger they were in. He had to warn her, but there was no way for him to do so without giving her away. It was too late anyway. Taric Molt stalked over to their table and stopped when he was still a few feet away. "You've led me a chase," he said softly. "But it's ended now. Get to your feet and come with me. Don't cause any trouble or it will be the worse for you. I don't much care what it takes to bring you back to Perenor."
Tagwin shook his head stubbornly.
"We are not coming with you. Not this boy and not me. We don't want your protection."
The druid's smile was quick and hard.
"I'm not offering protection, Tagwin. I'm offering you a chance to stay alive, nothing more. Don't mistake what this is about. Where is Aran Elicidal?"
Neither Penn nor Tagwin answered. If Taric Molt didn't know, that meant the elf was still free. That, in turn, meant there was a chance.
"Get to your feet," the druid said a second time. "We know what you've done with the Ardoris," Tagwin declared, raising his voice so that those around could hear him clearly. "We know what you'll do to us, too. We are not coming."
There was a muttering in the room, and Taric Molt's hard eyes grew angry.
"Enough of this, little men. Get up and walk out of here, or I'll drag you out."
A troll roughly the size of a barn pushed away from the serving bar and took a step forward. His blunt features tightened, one hand resting on a huge mace hanging from his belt.
"Leave the boy and the old man alone," he ordered. Terek Molt turned slowly to face him, away from the still open doors to the inn, his concentration divided between the troll and his quarry, so he didn't see Arin Elicital step out of the night.
Stay out of this, Molt said to the troll.
At that point, Kyber pushed away from the bar. Carrying the pitcher of ale in both hands, she crossed the room directly toward the table at which Penn and Tagwin were sitting. Terek Molt glanced sharply at her, but she averted her eyes as if not daring to look at him, and he started to turn back.
Get up, he said to Penn and Tagwin.
Kyber, from less than 6 feet away, threw the pitcher of ale all over him. The room exploded with shouts, its occupants leaping to their feet in a whirl of sudden movement. Chairs and tables were overturned, and glassware went crashing to the floor. The troll had his mace free and was swinging it at Terek Molt, who rolled out of the way just in time. But when he came to his feet to strike back, Arin's druid magic threw him across the room and against the wall, where he lay in a crumpled heap, screaming in fury. Gnome hunters came at Kyber, but her hands were already lifted and weaving, and the gnomes stumbled all over themselves in their efforts to stay upright. This way, she shouted at Penn and Tagwin, and broke for the kitchen. The boy and the dwarf didn't stop to ask if she knew what she was doing. They just went after her. The room was in chaos by then, its occupants surging up against one another in their efforts to get clear, most of them trying to reach the front door. The gnome hunters, still fighting to regain their equilibrium after Kyber's attack, were bowled over in the rush. A moment later, the lights went out and the room was engulfed in blackness. Penn and Tagwin were in the kitchen by then, with Kyber just ahead, flinging open the back door that led to the street. Without a backward glance, they plunged into the rain and fog and darkness. The streets were crowded, and it was difficult to move ahead at a brisk walk, let alone a run. Penn struggled to keep Kyber in sight, Tagwin pushing up against him from behind, both of them jostling and shoving to break free of the knots of people hindering their flight. Arin Elicital had disappeared, but Penn thought he must be somewhere close. Behind them, Fisherman's Lie was still in an uproar, shouts turning to cries of pain and anger, the windows breaking out, the entire place in blackness. Penn realized they had left everything behind in their escape, but knew there was no help for it. What mattered was getting away. What counted for something was staying alive. A burly dock worker shouldered Penn aside effortlessly. As the boy staggered, he felt something rip through his cloak, scoring his left arm. He heard the dock worker gasp and felt him clutch at his arm. As he tried to wrench free, he saw a dagger protruding from the man's chest, the blade buried to the hilt. The man fell heavily into the boy, his dead eyes open and staring. Penn looked around in shock and caught sight of something big scurrying along the peaks of the roofs, something cloaked and hooded and shadowy. Terek Molt, he thought at once, then realized that there hadn't been time for the druid to get out of the inn and come after them. The figure on the roof was much larger than Molt in any case, and it didn't move like him. It moved like some huge insect. It was coming down toward the dead man and Penn. Penderin, Kyber called back to him. He turned at the sound of her voice and began to run anew. Behind him, he heard gasps as the crowd realized what had happened to the dock worker. He didn't glance back to see if they were looking at him. He wasn't about to stop anyway. He wasn't going to do anything but keep running. They angled down a maze of narrow side streets, grunting and shoving their way clear of passers-by, until they finally reached the waterfront. Penn's arm was throbbing, and he glanced down in the light of the dockside lamps and saw blood soaking through his sleeve. The dagger had cut him from shoulder to elbow, the blade so sharp that even the heavy cloak had failed to blunt it. Who had attacked him? He knew he had been the target, not the dock worker. If the worker hadn't shoved him aside at just the right moment, Penn would be the one lying in the street back there. Glancing over his shoulder, he saw the shadowy figure giving chase, working its way swiftly along the warehouse roofs, scuttling along in the manner of a spider, arms and legs cocked out from its low-slung body. It was coming too fast for him to outrun it. Kyber! He shouted in sudden fear. The girl wheeled back, saw the figure as well, and thrust out both arms in a warding gesture. The magic caught the figure in mid-leap and sent it spinning out of sight. What was that? She shouted at him. He didn't reply. He had no idea what it was. He just knew he didn't want to see it again. Maybe he wouldn't. Maybe the fall had killed it, or injured it badly enough that it couldn't keep after them. As they began to rise again, he glanced back worriedly. He was right to do so. His pursuer was atop the roofs once more, leaping and bounding from one building to the next, coming fast.
Kyber!
He grabbed her arm and pointed. She turned a second time, saw the figure, lifted her arms to summon the magic, and immediately it disappeared. They stood looking for it, but it was as if the night and rain and mist had swallowed it whole. That hadn't happened, of course. It was still out there, coming for him. Only it was on the ground, lost in the shadows. The hairs on the back of Penn's neck pricked up. He backed toward the water, away from the buildings.
Run, Kyber hissed at him.
He did so, Tagwin beside him, their boots pounding on the wooden planks of the docks, the rain and mist a thick curtain all about them. Penn glanced toward the warehouses as he fled, searching for his pursuer. There was no one to be seen. But it was there, still chasing him. He could feel it. If it got close enough, it would use that dagger again, or another like it. It would send its blade hurtling out of the darkness, and he would be dead before he knew what had happened. His lungs burned and his legs ached from running, but he didn't slow. He had never been so scared. It was one thing to stand up to an enemy in the light face to face. It was another to be stalked by something he couldn't even see. They reached the skate low and clambered aboard in a rush. Not until they were crouched down behind the pilot box did Penn quit feeling as if a fresh blade was already winging its way out of the gloom toward his unprotected back. Scanning the lamplit shadows of the docks, he found no sign of his mysterious hunter. But he was scared enough that he was going to stay right where he was, with his back to the open water.
What was that? Kyber asked him for the second time, her breathing quick and labored.
Penn scanned the darkness, searching.
I don't know. I don't even know where it came from. Did you see what it did?
Killed that man, she whispered. But it meant to kill you, didn't it? Tagwin's rough face pressed forward so that their eyes met.
I think it did,
Penn answered, watching the mist shift along the dock front and down the side streets like a serpent. Shadows moved everywhere he looked.
I think it's still out there.
R.N. Elicidal, already on board, was speaking heatedly with Garhatch. R.N.'s clothes were disheveled and rain-soaked and his face flushed. He glanced over at the three hiding behind the pilot box wall, a hint of uncertainty in his blue eyes, then turned back to the rover captain, ordering him to cast off their mooring lines. But Hatch refused to do so, folding his arms across his chest and planting his feet. They weren't ready, he said. They hadn't finished their repairs.
They've found you, haven't they? He sneered. The druids? You think I don't know who you are or what you are about? I want no part of this. You can't pay me enough to take you farther. Get off my ship.
His rover crewman moved closer, ready to act on his behalf. From somewhere farther down the docks, shouts arose. The other pursuit. Penn had forgotten about Tarek Molt and his gnome hunters.
There, Tagwin hissed suddenly, pointing left. Something moved by that building.
They peered into the gloom. Penn's heart was hammering in his chest, blood pounding in his ears. He was cold and hot at the same time, so afraid that he was holding his breath. Then a huge shadow burst into view, leaping from the dockside onto the deck of the airship in a single bound, an impossible distance. It landed in a skid, its crooked limbs scrambling to find purchase on the smooth, damp wooden planking. R.N. Elicidal and Garhatch, startled, turned to look at it, both of them frozen in surprise. Penn caught the sudden flash of a blade, wicked and bright, but he couldn't make himself move either. It was Kyber who leapt up, screaming in challenge. Hands outstretched, she summoned the elemental magic in the form of a wind that picked up the dark form while it was still trying to regain its balance and threw it back over the side of the vessel into the cold lake waters. Penn and Tagwin rushed to the side of the airship and peered down. The dark figure was gone. On the dockside, the shouts were coming closer. Torchlight flickered through the mist.
Cast off, Aran Elicidal snapped at Garhatch, or I'll put you and your crew over the side and do it myself. The rover captain hesitated for just an instant, as if perhaps he would test this threat, then wheeled about, ordering his men to release the lines. The ropes fell away and the airship began to drift from the dock. Penn continued to scan the waters into which the dark thing had fallen, not convinced it had given up, not persuaded it wasn't going to come at him again. "Safety lines," Garhatch snapped. The Skatelow began to rise and the lake to drop away. Penn exhaled sharply. Still nothing. He glanced at Tagwin. The dwarf's rugged features reflected his fear. His eyes shifted to find the boys, and he shook his head. "Safety lines," Hatch repeated angrily. "Young Penn, if you can spare the time, would you bring Cinnaminson into the pilot box before you secure yourself?" Penn waved his response. He took a final look over the side before heading for the hatchway. The lake had disappeared beneath a sea of shifting mist. Then they were flying into the night, a solitary island in the deepening gloom, leaving Anachre and its horrors behind. Chapter 23. Darkness had fallen, stealing away the last of the daylight. Heavy fog closed on the airship, enfolding it in a swirling gray haze. There was no difference now between up or down, or even sideways, to those who sailed aboard the Skatelow. Everything looked the same. The day had been dreary to begin with, washed of color and empty of sunshine, but the night was worse. The clouds were so thickly massed overhead that there was not even the smallest hint of stars or moon. Below, the waters of the Lazarene had vanished as if drained from an unplugged basin. The lights of Anachre had vanished minutes after their departure. The world had disappeared. Penn brought Cinnaminson to her father. She squeezed Penn's hand as he led her along the corridor from her cabin and up the stairway to the deck, but neither of them spoke. There was too much to say and no time to say it. In the pilot box, she moved obediently to her father's side, saying as she did so, "I'm here, Papa." Penn was dismissed, told to go below, and he moved away. But he lingered at the hatchway with Kyber and Aran, staring out into the impenetrable fog, into the depthless night. If Cinnaminson wasn't able to navigate blind, he was thinking, they would be in trouble. There wasn't even the smallest landmark on which they could fix, no sky to read, no point of reference to track. There was nothing out there at all. "She's her father's compass, isn't she?" Aran asked him quietly. "His eyes in the darkness?" He nodded, looking at the druid in surprise. "How did you know?" "It was nosed about at the docks in Sionad. Some say she's his good luck charm. Some say she can see in darkness, even though she's blind in daylight. None of them have it right. I saw the way she moved the first few days we were aboard. She can sense the position of things in her mind, their location, their look and feel. She said she sees the stars in her mind, even in mist and rain like this. That's how she navigates." "A gift," Aran Elicidal murmured. "But her father thinks it belongs to him, because she is his child." Penn nodded. "He thinks she belongs to him." They could hear her speaking softly to her father, giving him instructions, a heading to take, a course to follow. His hands moved smoothly over the controls in response, turning the airship slightly to starboard, bringing up her bow as he did so, easing ahead through the gloom. In a less stressful situation, he might have noticed them watching and immediately ordered them below so that they would not discover his secret. He might have refused to proceed at all, but that night he was so preoccupied that he didn't even know they were there. The mist thickened the farther away from land they flew, swirling like witch's brew around the airship, alive with strange shadows and unexpected movement. There was no wind, and yet the haze roiled as if there were. Penn felt uneasy at the phenomenon, not understanding how it could occur. He glanced again at Aran Elicidal, but the druid was staring straight ahead, his concentration focused on something else. He was listening. Penn listened as well, but he could hear nothing beyond the creaking of the ship's rigging. He looked to Kyber, but she shook her head to indicate that she didn't hear anything either. Then Penn froze. There was something, after all. At first, he wasn't sure what it was.
It sounded a little like breathing, deep and low, like a sleeping man exhaling, only not that either. He furrowed his brow in concentration, trying to place it. It must be the wind, he thought. The wind sweeping over the hull or through the rigging or along the decks. But he knew it wasn't. The sound grew louder, crept closer, as if a sleeping giant had woken and was coming over for a look. Penn glanced quickly at Aran, but the druid's gaze was intense and fixed, directed outward into the mist, searching. Uncle, Kyber whispered, and there was an unmistakable hint of fear in her voice. He nodded without looking at her.
It is the lake, he said. It is alive.
Penn had no idea what that meant, but he didn't like the sound of it. Lakes weren't alive in the sense that they could breathe, so why did it sound as if this one was? He tried to pick up a rhythm to the sound, but it was unsteady and sporadic, harsh and labored. The ship sailed into the teeth of it, sliding smoothly through the fog, down the giant's throat and into its belly. Penn could see it in his mind. He tried to change the picture to something less threatening, but could not. Then abruptly, ethereal forms appeared, incomplete and hazy, riding the windless mist. They brought the sound with them, carried it in their shadowy, insubstantial bodies, bits and pieces echoing all about them as they moved. Penn shrank back as several approached, sliding over the railing and across the airship's rain-slick deck. Cinnaminson gasped and her father swore angrily, swatting ineffectually at the wraith forms. The dead come to visit us, Aran Elicidal said quietly. This is the Lazarene, the prison of the dead who have not found their way to the netherworld and still wander the four lands.
What do they want? Kyber whispered.
Aran shook his head. I don't know. The shades were all about the Skaitlow, sweeping through her rigging like birds. The breathing grew louder, filling their ears, a windstorm of trouble building to something terrible. Slowly, steadily, vibrations began to shake the airship, causing the rigging to hum and the spars to rattle. Penn felt them all the way down to his bones. Seconds later, its pitch shifted to a frightening howl, a wail that engulfed them in an avalanche of sound. Penn went to his knees, racked with pain. The wail tightened like a vice around his head, crushing his ineffectual defenses. In the pilot box, in a futile effort to keep the sound at bay, Cinnaminson doubled over, her hands clapped over her ears. Gar Hatch was howling in fury, fighting to remain in control of the airship but losing the battle. "Do something!" Kyber screamed at everyone and no one in particular, her eyes squeezed shut, her face twisted. Like the legendary sirens, the shades were driving the humans aboard the Skaitlow mad. Their voices would paralyze the sailors, strip them of their sanity, and leave them catatonic. Already Penn could feel himself losing control, his efforts at protecting his hearing and his mind failing. If he had the wish song, he thought he might have a way to fight back. But he had no defense against this, no magic to combat it. Nor did any of them. Except, perhaps... He glanced quickly at Aran Elicidal. The druid was standing rigid and white-faced against the onslaught, hands weaving, lips moving, calling on his magic to save them. It was a terrible choice he was making, Penn knew. Using magic would give them away to the Gallifile in an instant. It would lead Taric Molt and his gnome hunters right to them. But what other choice did they have? The boy dropped to his knees, fighting to keep from screaming, the wailing so frenzied and wild that the deck planking was vibrating. Then abruptly, everything went perfectly still, and they were enfolded in a silence so deep and vast that it felt as if they were packed in cotton wadding and buried in the ground. Around them, the mist continued to swirl and the shades to fly, but the wailing was no longer heard. Penn got to his feet hesitantly, watching as the others did the same.
We are safe, but we've given ourselves away, Aran said quietly. He looked drained of strength, his face drawn and worn.
Maybe they didn't come after us, Kyber offered. Her uncle did not respond. Instead, he moved away from them, crossing the deck to the pilot box. After a moment's hesitation, Penn and Kyber followed. Gar Hatch turned at their approach, his hard face twisting with anger.
This is your doing, druid, he snapped. Get below and stay there.
Cinnaminson, Aran Elicidal said to the girl, ignoring her father. She swung toward the sound of his voice, her pale face damp with mist, her blind eyes wide.
We have to hide. Can you find a place for us to do so?
Don't answer him, Gar Hatch roared. He swung down out of the pilot box and advanced on the druid. Let her be. She's blind, in case you hadn't noticed. How do you expect her to help?
Aran Elicidal's hand lifted in a warding gesture. Don't come any closer, Captain, he said. Gar Hatch stopped, shaking with rage.
Let's not pretend we both don't know what she can and can't do. She's your eyes in this muck. She can see better than either of us. If she can't, then send her below and steer this ship yourself. Because a druid warship tracks us, and if you don't find a way off this lake and find it quickly, it will be on top of us.
Gar Hatch came forward another step, his fists knotted.
I should never have brought you aboard. I should never have agreed to help you. I do, and look what it costs me. You take my daughter, you take my ship, and you will probably cost me my life.
Aran stood his ground. Don't be stupid. I take nothing from you but your services, and I paid for those. Among them, like it or not, is your daughter's talent. Now give her your permission to find a place for us to hide before it is too late.
Hatch started to say something, then his eyes widened in shock as the huge ironclad rams of the Gallifile surged out of the fog bank.
Cinnaminson, he shouted, leaping into the pilot box and seizing the controls.
He dropped the nose of the Skatelow so hard and so fast that Penn and his companions slid forward into the side of the pilot box, grabbing onto railings and ropes and anything else that would catch them. The airship plummeted, then leveled out and shot forward into the haze, all in seconds. As quick as that, they were alone again. The Gallifile vanished back into the fog.
"Which way?" Gar Hatch demanded of his daughter.
Her voice steady, Cinnaminson centered herself on the console, both hands gripping the railing, and began to give her father instructions, calling out headings. Penn, Kyber, and Aran Elicidal righted themselves and snapped their safety harnesses in place, keeping close to the pilot box to watch what was happening. Gar Hatch ignored them, speaking only to his daughter, listening to her replies and making the necessary adjustments in the setting of the Skatelow's course. Penn looked over his shoulder, then skyward, searching the mist for the Gallifile. She was nowhere to be seen, but she was close at hand. He sensed her, massive and deadly, an implacable hunter in search of her prey. He felt her bulk pressing down through the haze, looking to crush him over the Lazarene the way she would have crushed him over the Rainbow Lake almost 3 weeks ago. He was aware suddenly that the shades had vanished, gone back into the shroud of mist and gloom they had swum through moments earlier, sunk down into the waters of the Lazarene.
"Why didn't the dead go after Terek Molt?" he asked Aran suddenly. "Why didn't they attack the Gallifile, too?"
The druid glanced over.
"Because Molt protects his vessel with druid magic, something he can afford to do, and we cannot."
He paused, hands knuckle white about the pilot box railing, droplets of water beaded on his narrow elven features. "Besides, Pandaren, he may have summoned the dead in the first place. He has that power."
"Shades," the boy whispered, and the word was like a prayer.
They sailed ahead in silence, an island once more in the mist and fog, a rabbit in flight from a fox. All eyes searched the gloom for the Gallifile, while Cinnaminson called out course headings and Gar Hatch made the airship respond. The wind picked up again, set loose as they reached the Lazarene center, and the haze began to dissipate. Below, the lake waters were choppy and dark, the sound of their waves clear in the fog's silence. Aran Elicidal leaned over the pilot box railing.
"Where do we sail?" he asked Gar Hatch. "The slags," the big man answered dully. "There's plenty of places to hide in there, places we will never be found. We just need to clear the lake."
Penn touched the druid's arm and looked at him questioningly.
"Wetlands," the druid said. "Miles and miles of them, stretching all along the northeastern shoreline. Swamp and floodplain, cypress and cedar. A tangle of old growth and grasses blanketed with mist and filled with quicksand that can swallow whole ships. Dangerous, even if you know what you're doing."
He nodded toward Hatch.
"He's made the right choice."
"She has," Penn corrected silently,
"for it was Cinnaminson who set their course,
through whose mind's eye they sought their way, and in whose hands they placed their trust. The mist continued to thin, the sky above opening to a scattering of stars, the lake below silver-tipped and shimmering. Their cover would be gone in a few minutes, and Pan saw no sign of the shore. The mist still hung in thick curtains in the distance, so he assumed the shore was there. But it was a long way off, and the wind was in their face, slowing their passage. Then all at once clouds blew in and rain began to fall, sweeping across the decking in a cold black wash, and quickly they were soaked through. It poured for a time, thunder booming in the distance, and then just as suddenly it stopped again. At the same moment, the wind died to nothing.
20 degrees starboard, Cinnaminson told her father. We'll find better speed on that heading.
Oh, she gasped suddenly. Behind us, Papa.
They all swung about in response and found the Gallifile emerging from the remnants of the fog bank, sails furled and lashed, the warship flying on the power of her diapson crystals. She was moving fast, surging through the night, bearing down on them like a tidal wave. Gar Hatch threw the thruster levers all the way forward and yelled to his rover crewmen to drop the mainsail. Penn saw the reason for it at once. The mainsail was a drag on the ship in that windless air and would be of less help if the wind resumed from the east. The Skatelo was better off flying on stored power as well, though she could not begin to match the speed of the Gallifile. Still, she was the smaller, lighter craft, and if she was lucky, might be able to outmaneuver her pursuer. The chase was underway in earnest. The fog that had offered concealment only moments earlier all but vanished. Penn did not care for what he saw as he watched the Gallifile draw closer. As fast as she was coming, the Skatelo could not outrun her. The Lazarene stretched away in all directions, vast and unchanging, and there was no sign of the shoreline they so desperately needed to reach. Clever maneuvers would get them only so far. Cinnaminson was still calling out tacks and headings, and Gar Hatch worked the controls frantically in response, trying to catch a bit of stray wind here, to skip off a sudden gust of air there. But neither could do anything to change their situation. The Gallifile continued to close steadily. Then a fresh rain squall washed over them, and R.N. Elicidal, seeing his chance, stepped away from the railing, arms raised skyward, and called on his magic to change the squall's direction, sending it whipping toward the Druid warship. It caught the Gallifile head-on, but by then it had changed into sleet so thick and heavy that it enveloped the bigger ship and swallowed it whole. Clinging to the Gallifile in a white, swirling mass, it coated the decking and masts with ice, turning the airship to a bone-bleached corpse. Now the Skatelo began to pull away. Burdened by the weight of the ice, the Gallifile was foundering. Penn saw flashes of red fire sweeping her masts and spars, druid magic attempting to burn away the frigid coating. The fire had an eerie look to it, flaring from within the storm cloud like dragon eyes, like embers in a forge. Ahead, the fog bank drew nearer. R.N. collapsed next to Penn and Kyber, his lean face drawn and pale, his eyes haunted. He was close to exhaustion. "Find us a place to hide, Cinnaminson," he breathed softly. "Find it quickly." Pressed against the pilot box wall, rain-soaked and cold, Penn peered in at the girl. She stood rigid and unmoving at the forward railing, her face lifted. She was speaking so low that Penn could not make out the words, but Gar Hatch was listening intently, bent close to her, his burly form hunched down within his cloak. He had dropped the Skatelo so close to the Lazarene that she was almost skimming the surface. Penn heard the chop of the lake waters, steady and rough. The wind was back, whipping about them from first one direction and then the other, sweeping down out of the charnels, cold and bleak. Then they were sliding into the mist again, its gray shroud wrapping about and closing them away. Everything disappeared, vanished in an instant.
"Starboard 5 degrees, Papa," Cinnaminson called out sharply. "Altitude, quickly!"
Blinded by the murky haze, Penn could only hear tree branches scrape the underside of the hull as the Skatelo nosed upward again. A shrieking, a rending of wood, then silence once more. The airship leveled off. Penn was gripping the pilot box railing so hard his hands hurt. Kyber was crouched right beside him, her eyes tightly closed, her breathing quick and hurried.
There, Papa, Cinnaminson cried out suddenly. Ahead of us, an inlet. Bring her down quickly.
The skate-load dipped abruptly, and Pen experienced a momentary sensation of falling. Then the airship steadied and settled. Again there was contact, but softer, a rustling of damp grasses and reeds rather than a scraping of tree limbs. He smelled the fetid wetland waters and the stink of swamp gas rising to meet them. He heard a quick scattering of wings. Then the skate-low settled with a small splash and a lurch, sliding through water and mist and darkness, and everything went still.
I was so frightened, she whispered to him, her blind gaze settling on his face, her head held just so, as if she were seeing him with her milky eyes instead of her mind.
You didn't look frightened, he whispered back. He squeezed her hands. You looked calmer than any of us.
I don't know how I looked. I only know how I felt. I kept thinking that all it would take was one mistake for us to be caught, especially when that warship appeared and was chasing us.
Pen glanced skyward, finding only mist and gloom, no sign of the Gallifile or anything else. Around them, the waters of the wetlands lapped softly against the hull of the skate-low. Even though he couldn't see them, he heard the rustle of the limbs from the big trees that Cinnaminson told him were all about them. For anyone to find the skate-low there, they would have to land right on top of it. From above, even if the air were clear instead of like soup, they were invisible. Their concealment was perfect and complete. 2 hours had passed since their landing, and in that time the others had gone to sleep, save for the rover who kept watch from the bow. Pen stood with Cinnaminson in the pilot box, looking out into the haze, barely able to see the man who stood only 20 yards away. Before that night, the boy would not have been allowed on deck at all. But maybe the rules were no longer so important to Gar Hatch, since he and Aran Elicidal knew each other's secrets, and neither was fooling the other about how things stood. Pen didn't think the rover captain's opinion of him had changed. He didn't think Hatch wanted him around his daughter. But maybe he had decided to put up with it for the time being, since their time together was growing short. Whatever the case, Pen would take what he could get.
What are you thinking? She asked him, brushing damp strands of her sandy blonde hair away from her face.
Your father is generous to allow us to be on deck alone like this. Perhaps he thinks better of me now.
Now that he knows who you are and who's hunting you?
Oh, yes. I expect he would like to be best friends. I expect